You're in tune with Broadcast House in Hartford, Connecticut. This is 1080 Radio, WTIC, and we invite you to stay tuned in 1 minute for a special memorial program to the late Hartford actor, Ed Begley. The time right now, Eastern Daylight Saving Time, is 10:30.
And the winner is Ed Begley, and he's been winning.
He had won many honors, but this was the biggest prize of all. The coveted Oscar, awarded him in 1963 for his role in Sweet Bird of Youth. As Ed Begley looked out into an audience of his peers, his mind recalled an earlier time, many years before. And in that strong, beautifully controlled voice of his, he said simply, "It's a long way from Hartford." This is Dick Bertel. Ed Begley died Tuesday night in Hollywood. Tonight we recall his life and career in this salute to a great actor. With me in the studio is George Bowe, Vice President of Special Events for WTIC Radio and Television, and producer of the forthcoming Channel 3 People and Places program, A Connecticut Yankee in Mark Twain's House, featuring the voice of Ed Begley. George, you were a personal friend of Ed's during his long career. When did you first contact him concerning the Mark Twain show?
Well, this was in February. I talked with Ed, and he was in New York City at the time, and had just finished a run of Our Town, and was about to begin a videotaping of the Hallmark Easter show for television.
Mm-hmm.
Ed then returned to the coast, and we resumed our discussions. He decided he could do it for us, and then I sent scripts to his home in California, and also the same script to Toronto, Canada, because Ed was about to leave for there to go up to Toronto and videotape a special program for the Canadian Broadcasting Company.
There's an interesting story concerning that contact in Toronto at his hotel.
Yes. Ed walked into the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in Toronto, and the desk clerk said to him, "Mr. Begley, welcome, and you have a letter waiting for you from Hartford, Connecticut." And Ed told me this over the phone himself, and he said to the clerk, "Ah, a letter from home."
And Ed always felt that Hartford was his home, didn't he?
He certainly did, Dick, as you well know, and whenever he got back here, he always made it a point to go around and visit his old friends in Hartford, both at WTIC and elsewhere.
Well, naturally, I came to see my old friends and, you know, the old stamping ground, WTIC, where I got my start in radio in 1931.
And what I liked about Ed coming back on these visits, he not only said hello to the old-timers that used to work with him, but to the new fellows that were there. He was just as friendly, and they meant so much to him as well as the old boys.
What is your first recollection of Ed? When did you meet him?
I came here in 1935 and met him, as I recall, after being here just a few days with the Guy Hedlund Company.
I'm here in the study.
Oh, I've come over to see the sick lad you brought home from India.
Well, sure, now let's leave, neighbor, leave you, lass. But I think you'd better wait a while. There's a great doctor in there examining my nephew now.
Oh, is he worse?
No, indeed, he's better.
Then why the doctor?
Well, it's a special doctor, a great psychiatrist.
Oh.
The one we had before was just a common weekday kind of a doctor, you understand.
This man could take a script by an unknown and by an inexperienced writer and just make it sound great because he really lived every character he played, and he was an actor. He could play different characters. The character did not have to be written for Ed Begley.
As a matter of fact, Ed's voice was so flexible that he could play many parts on one show.
Yes, there were shows, I believe, where he talked to himself in two different characters. This was not unusual.
Ed's experience here at WTIC, of course, led to his moving to New York in the early 40s, I believe.
1942, I finally decided that it was now or never. So I went down to New York in September 1942. Everybody thought I had a contract in New York at the time. They said, oh, he wouldn't give up, a sure thing and go down there. But I didn't. I was auditioning down there. Paul Lucas had given me a letter. Mr. Morenci had given me a letter. And through these people, I did get auditions down there. And then went right on from there and became probably the busiest radio actor in New York.
Ed met with success not only in radio, but also on the Broadway stage. And Jim Maloney, the director of special events at Central Connecticut State College, met Ed on the Broadway stage during the run of Inherit the Wind. How did you meet Ed, Jim?
Well, actually, I met him at the rehearsals of Inherit the Wind, although I had seen him and, of course, knew his name for many years and had been a fan of his on radio in the old Guy Hedlund days. But actually, that was the first time we had met, although I had seen him, as I said, when he had worked at the old WNBC studios in Hartford.
How did he impress you as an actor?
Oh, Ed is... He was probably the most vital actor that we have in America. Hugh Griffith in England is something of the same. Not all but a bull driving force and a vocal quality that was tremendous. And a quick instinct for parts and the ability to lose himself in a great many roles.
Ed was a character actor. I think that's a fair description. Most character actors are not well known by name, are they?
That's right. Many character actors are known by their faces, by the association with parts they've done. And that was one of the amazing things about Ed was, as I say, I spent a lot of time in his company. We'd go out to restaurants together, to shows and so forth. And he was well known by name. And Ed was always very affable with people who did come up. He liked to talk to people. He came to the college shortly after I had taken a job and spent a few hours on campus, talked in an assembly and talked to people in the halls and everywhere. He was very, very popular.
Would it be fair to say that Ed was an actor's actor?
He's certainly very highly regarded among other actors. He was not an actor who would try to steal scenes or to push anyone out of it. He did his job there very, very competently. But you said something about a character. That's two different definitions, I think, of character actor. There are character actors who are more or less nondescript, who can fit into many different characters. And there are character actors who are characters. They themselves are a certain part, and that's all they play, maybe comic or otherwise, but they're characters, I'd say. A character actor is one. Ed is partly in between because he had a strong personality of his own that would come across, but still, he would be completely different in many different roles. He played a great many heavies, and he played sympathetic roles also.
Of course, Ed was so well known, I think, for the part of William Jennings Bryan in Inherit the Wind that perhaps people today forget that he had many other triumphs on Broadway, didn't he, Jennings?
Oh, he certainly did. Of course, All My Sons, the Arthur Miller play, was probably up to the time of Inherit the Wind, his most important one. His first show on Broadway was a Saroyan play called Getaway Old Man, in which he played a very miserable movie tycoon supposed to be based on Louis B. Mayer. And he won an award for it, even though the play didn't last long. But there's a story he tells on himself about that play in that somebody described him as a fat Jimmy Durante, the character that he was playing in that show. But he also had Look Homeward Angel, the Thomas Wolfe play. And Ed did something, too. In addition, he would play many parts, Broadway successes, at colleges with student groups, like The Middle of the Night, for example. And he had a very renowned career on Broadway, and of course gone back and forth from Broadway to pictures and the radio.
And let's not forget television. He was one of the very few actors who played in all four mediums.
I don't know whether anyone else has mentioned this or not, but he was one of the most successful radio actors in that he wouldn't have to rehearse. He would do several shows in a day. They would have an actor not as well regarded do all the rehearsing, all the timing, and Ed would step in at the last minute, take the script when the show was actually on the air.
Thank you, Jim Maloney, for telling us of the Broadway aspect of Ed's career. Well, I guess the most famous role that Ed created on radio was Charlie Chan, but there were so many others. George, I wonder if you remember one that Ed was featured in, Will Brown. Tell me, first of all, if you recall the name of the show.
Oh, my memory fails me, Dick. I don't.
All right. The Aldrich family.
Oh, yes.
Ezra Stone is Henry, Jackie Kelk is Homer Brown, and Agnes Moorehead is playing the part of Mrs. Brown, but Will Brown is Ed Begley.
Well.
An anonymous better, Will?
Yeah.
Oh, Homer, stop staring into your soup and start eating it.
That's what Sam told me, Elizabeth. Imagine a high school kid doing a thing like that.
And Sam didn't know who it was.
Oh. Homer, stop that. All he said was the note was signed Desperate.
A high school boy. You know, Will, if it didn't sound too ridiculous even for him, I'd guess it was Sam's own son, Henry.
Oh.
Homer, stop fishing around in your soup with your fingers. Take another spoon.
Well, whoever he is, he's an idiot.
What about his parents?
They're idiots, too.
Again, the remarkable facility to change his voice to create a character. Some of the other shows that Ed appeared on. The Alan Young Show, he was Papa Dylan Pfeffer. In Big Sister, Peter Stone and Charles Daniels. Sergeant O'Hara in The Fat Man. Dr. Mildermall and Joyce Jordan, Girl Intern. Oscar Finch in Life Can Be Beautiful. Francis Hayfield in Mert and Marge. He played the part of Dan Brill in Official Detective. And he was Lieutenant Levinson in Richard Diamond. And he played in Stella Dallas, played many parts on Stella Dallas. Mm,
yes, indeed. Ed, in a show called Broadway Is My Beat, was a dressmaker who was involved in a murder.
I want to thank you for bringing me down here, Mr. Clover. You police work just as effectively as we dressmakers.
And I want to thank you, Mr. Conrad.
You know, this is my opportunity to see you detectives detect it firsthand. Nick Carter stuff, huh? Got a show full of Nick Carter. Broadens the mind like Latin.
Yeah, Sir Tagli, what is it?
Oh, news, then.
What's on your mind? Come on.
Who placed the gun?
To whom?
To this guy right here, to Lionel Conrad.
Book him.
Let me tell you something.
Book him for murder. Call the D.A.
The gun was stolen. It was stolen from
me. Get him out of here, Sir Tagli. He's for the D.A.
Come on, you.
But the gun was stolen. I didn't do it. I didn't. Why didn't you tell us about the gun?
Because of what you're doing to me now, accusing me of murder.
What are you trying to say? I knew it was my gun that killed Ira. The description of it was in the newspaper. Why shouldn't I have kept quiet about it? My fingerprints were on it. I haven't got a chance.
What training, what dramatic training did Ed have? As far as I know, Ed had absolutely no schooling in dramatics or in the theater. Ed's training was probably the very best training in the world. He had a dramatic life from a little boy right on up. He loved people, and he was able to interpret people. And I remember once we had on the early days of World War II a series called The Road to Victory. Scripts were written by WTIC personnel who had a flair for writing. Anyone that could write something would at least have a chance. I called up Ed and I said, Ed, we want you for a show next Tuesday night. And the show went on at 6:30 in the evening. Ed had to work a little late. He came downtown, got off the bus, rushed up to the studios at about 6:20. So we didn't have time to rehearse the whole program. But it didn't bother me as the producer because I had such great faith in Ed's ability. I met him at the elevator. I handed him the script, and I said, Ed, you are a Nazi flag hanging on the wall, and you're a mean Nazi flag, and you're talking to an American flag that is hanging next to you. I said, that's the story. You've got to be a Nazi flag. Well, I want to tell you, Dick, that he went in the studio. We did a little rehearsal, a little voice level. He started to read those lines, and you would swear that you were listening to a nasty Nazi flag talking. He was just fantastic. Well, he must have been. For example, he recorded the soundtrack for the Mark Twain special, which will be on May 13th on Channel 3, in Toronto, by himself, with no director at his side. Now, what direction did he have from you, and in what form did it take?
Telephone. He called me from Toronto and said, I have received the script, and I will arrange for studio recording facilities, since I knew no recording company in Toronto. And he said, how do you see this? So we just discussed on the phone that this is Mark Twain, Ed. This is Mark Twain at the age of 70, let's say, reflecting back on his life in his home in Hartford. And he loved that home in Hartford, and he loved his family. And that everything in that house was very dear to him, Ed. And this was just about the gist of it. Now, I said, this is it. You take it from there. Ed went into the recording studio that night and did the recording. We got the master tape shipped down here to Hartford. We played it back, and it couldn't have been better in our estimation. It was Mark Twain at 70 doing exactly what we had discussed on the telephone.
It's amazing, George, in listening to that original soundtrack that he did for the show, how he can
jump from the character to himself and back to the character again.
Yes, oh, he had a great facility for that. And in front of me, Dick, this is the very script that Ed read from when he recorded up in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And when we got the master tape back here, we discovered that Ed would be reading in character as Mark Twain, and he'd have this aging that he put in, you must have fond memories and so forth. And he'd come to the bottom of the page, you'd hear the page turn, then you'd hear Ed Begley say in his normal voice, page 15, and he'd go right back into character. I remember the storytelling days vividly, right? And he always hit the character at the top of each page after he gave the paper. Right on the nose.
George, you're the producer of that television show, but would you mind if we allowed our audience to hear the raw soundtrack just so that we can illustrate that?
Exactly. This is a little bit, Dick, that you'll hear where Mark Twain is recalling storytelling to his children. And this is Ed Begley as the voice of Mark Twain.
Page 15. I remember the storytelling days vividly. They were a difficult and exciting audience, those little creatures. If they brought me a picture and required me to build a story to it, they would cover the rest of the page with their pudgy hands to keep me from stealing an idea from it. Once, Clara required me to build a sudden tale out of a plumber and a boa constrictor. And I had to do it. She didn't know what a boa constrictor was until... Page 16. She didn't know what a boa constrictor was until he developed in the tail. Then she was better satisfied with it than ever.
And then, to show how great this... man was and how much humility he had, he called back a couple of days later and he said, how was it? Was it all right? I'll do it over again. And believe me, when Ed did something, you didn't have to do it over again.
No. Well, I can't imagine Ed being anything less than great. When he moved to the Broadway stage, and that was actually rather early in his New York career, did he maintain contact with the people here at the station?
Yes, very much so. And when we would get to New York on a visit, frequently we'd look up Ed. He had an apartment, and he was always glad to see you and very happy to take you into a rehearsal if he happened to be going to one, and never tried to push you off. And Ed always was very proud of the people that he knew and worked with and loved in Hartford.
Did he ever aspire to a motion picture career? Do you think that he ever envisioned himself as winning an Oscar?
I think he dreamed of it. He must have, because Ed certainly thought of and envisioned himself getting into pictures. I think Ed was the type that he just had to wind up in motion pictures. He had a great voice, as you said. One of the most versatile voices, in my estimation, that ever hit this industry. But I think Ed envisioned himself in front of a camera and acting. Acting was Ed's whole life. He couldn't do anything else. He wouldn't do anything else. He knew that this was what he was intended for. And so movies, television, radio, stage, anything. Ed was an actor. He was an actor when he was with you, but a sincere actor when he was next to you. And, oh, he thought so much of people. He just loved people.
And another aspect of this man's ability was the fact that he could recall a script months, years later, couldn't he, Joe?
Yes, and this is very unusual for an actor. He usually, once he has done a part, he forgets it, throws it aside because he has to go on to memorization of another. But I recall one time when... Ed Begley was visiting Hartford and sat down in the studio with Bob Steele, and Bob said, Ed, why won't you recite Casey at the Bat for us? This is the season for it. And Begley went right off just like that. Why, of course, and recited Casey at the Bat.
The outlook wasn't brilliant for the Mudville Nine that day. The score stood 4-2 with but one inning more to play. And so when Cooney died at first and Burroughs did the same, a sickly silence fell upon the patrons of the game. A straggling few got up to go in deep despair. The rest clung to the hope which springs eternal in the human breast. They thought if only Casey could but get a whack at that, they'd put up even money now with Casey at the bat. But Flynn preceded Casey, as did also Jimmy Blake, and the former was a pudding, and the latter was a fake. So upon that stricken multitude, grim melancholy sat, for there seemed but little chance of Casey's getting to the bat. But Flynn let drive a single, to the wonderment of all, and Blake, the much despised, tore the cover off the ball. And when the dust had lifted and saw what had occurred, there was Jimmy safe at second and Flynn hugging third. Then from the 5,000 throats and more, there rose a lusty yell. It rambled through the valley and it rattled in the dell. It knocked upon the mountain and recoiled upon the flat for Casey. Mighty Casey was advancing to the bat. There was ease in Casey's manner as he stepped into his place. There was pride in Casey's bearing and a smile on Casey's face. And when responding to the cheers, he lightly doffed his hat. No stranger in that crowd could doubt 'twas Casey at the bat. 10,000 eyes were on him as he rubbed his hands with dirt. 5,000 tongues applauded when he wiped them on his shirt. Then while the writhing pitcher ground the ball into his hip, defiance gleamed in Casey's eye. A sneer curled Casey's lip. And now the leather-covered sphere comes hurtling through the air, and Casey stood a-watching it in haughty grandeur there. Close by the sturdy batsman, the ball unheeded sped. "That ain't my style," said Casey. "Strike one," the umpire said. From the benches, black with people, there went up a muffled roar, like the beating of the storm waves on a stern and distant shore. "Kill him! Kill the umpire!" shouted someone in the stand. And it's likely they'd have killed him had not Casey raised his hand. With a smile of Christian charity, great Casey's visage shone. He stilled the rising tumult. He bade the game go on. He signaled to the pitcher, and once more the spheroid flew. But Casey still ignored it, and the umpire said, "A strike two." "Fraud," cried the maddened thousands, and the echo answered, "Fraud." But one scornful look from Casey, and that audience was awed. They saw his face grow stern and cold. They saw his muscles strain, and they knew that Casey wouldn't let that ball go by again. The sneer is gone from Casey's lips. His teeth are clenched in hate. He pounds with cruel violence his bat upon the plate. And now the pitcher holds the ball, and now he lets it go, and now the air is shattered by the force of Casey's blow. Oh, somewhere in this favored land, the sun is shining bright. The band is playing somewhere, and somewhere hearts are light. And somewhere men are laughing, and somewhere children shout. But there is no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck out.
George, Ed is gone now, but how best will you remember him, do you feel?
Well, I'll always remember Ed Begley, as, and I'm sure others around WTIC will probably feel the same way about this, as not only our ideal actor, because we have always we've followed his career, and we've been happy every time that he has had some success, and he's had so many, but he's a great person and a great actor, and Begley is going to be with us for a long, long time.
As Ed Begley expressed it in Hollywood when he was given his Oscar, indeed, it's a long way from Hartford. My thanks to George Bowe, Vice President of Special Events for WTIC Radio and Television, for sharing his personal recollections of Ed Begley with us tonight. And to those others who contributed to the story of this great actor who never forgot that Hartford was his home. Special thanks must be given to Don Brush of Hartford and to Ed Corcoran of South Windsor for sharing their collection of Ed Begley radio excerpts with us. This salute to Ed Begley was produced by William Marks and engineered by Bob Sherrago. This is Dick Bertel.